So, hi, Sabrina George interviewing Earl Oaken, part three of New Comedy Radio. So you now were making a name for yourself on the comedy scene. You were doing comedy clubs, you were doing festivals and so... folk clubs.
There wasn't much of a comedy scene yet. It was just beginning. There was the Comic Strip. There was the Original Comedy Store, which was in, I think, Water Street or somewhere.
Right, yeah.
I did that once, and it was hosted by some idiot American who was also involved with the Pizza Express Jazz Club. A nasty kid. And I went on, and he wanted to have me on during the interval. And I remember him saying, right, well, that's the end of the first half. Earl Oaken will now entertain you, but if you want to go to the bar, that's fine. I thought, no, I'm not going for that.
As a sort of interlude background music type thing, which is not what you do at all. Yeah.
Strange man he was. So I thought that was going, this one was going, and then the other odd one started like then on.
Do you think that might have been why that's what I feel now? There's this tremendous sense of competitiveness. I think the comics now are very professional, but there's this huge competitiveness amongst comics, and I've been on telly, I've done this coffee commercial, or whatever it is. Whereas from what I'm hearing about comics that were around early on, the alternative scene, there was less of that because there was no real career structure to follow. Do you think that was part of why they were much more relaxed about doing it?
At that stage, you see, they were running a gong show there.
Right.
People getting gonged off if they weren't.
Funny.
I don't like it. The thing about the folk circuit was it was very gentle, and you would learn your audience skills. The guys who ran comedy club, there was a wonderful man who was in Edinburgh, who was a shipmate, literally built ships with Billy Connolly. His name was Danny Carr, and he's dead now. Very sad. He had diabetes, that sort of went wrong. And he was a spherical Glaswegian. And he wasn't the greatest comedian that ever lived. He wasn't the greatest singer or guitarist. But by God, he was a great entertainer. And he was a host, the ultimate professional compere stroke host of folk clubs. So if not many floor singers turned up, he would sing you some songs, some of which were traditional, some of which were very funny. I remember one that was called the Yorman Song. And the chorus of which was him going, this whole thing was to see how many people could get yawning in the audience. So he used to run, I remember he used to do Edinburgh every year, and I used to go down there as an escape from the rest of it. So there was all that sort of fun amongst friends. Now, if anybody thought of booing or heckling at a comedy club, you'd be thrown out.
They've got a Glaswegian shipmaker to come and sort things out. Yeah.
No, it didn't have to be. I mean, but anyway,
yeah.
I started my career at a wonderful place called the Troubadour. It was run by an old friend of mine, also no more, Red Sullivan and Martin Windsor. They ran folk night down there for God knows how many years. Certainly before my time. My guess is they started in the late 50s and it carried on till the whole thing was shut. And you did not heckle. If you didn't like somebody, you didn't clap as much. You came off to a resounding silence. That's the worst that could happen. You knew you died, but it wasn't, you know, humiliating and nasty. They would actually, the audience would be looking for something to appreciate. They wanted to like you. That was
so you'd gradually work up, build up. Yeah.
I mean, I got recordings of myself doing a song which I still close my set with now, 20 years ago. It's just isn't as good. I've added odd lines, my timing's better. It's essentially the same material, but I'm getting three times the number of laughs. And, I mean, that's just an example, that's a microcosm, but the whole thing worked like that. You spent, you know, 10 years on that circuit and you gradually got better. That's how it was. So that's where I learned my craft, on that circuit. And there was no feeling of... What you would do is you go into a floor spot, you do 5 minutes, and then if it went really well, this year, and then you get your gigs that way, because they'd actually see you do a floor spot. It wasn't an audition. That would be much more pressure. You just did it for fun anyway, and then you said, did you like that? Do you fancy it? Oh yeah, why not? Blah, blah, blah. So that's the way the folk circuit worked. It was a community, and it was, you know, it was sort of left-wing base, so people were like that.
Are you finished? We should go.
No, come and sit, though. Join in if you want to.
Come and sit down, I'll bore you.
Neil McCarthy's just joined us.
You
used to
remember me from having the
wall bang. I do. See you banging the wall right now.
So then, how did you... So then, what happened that got you to do your own show and take it to Edinburgh? Or how did that evolve?
I already had my own show. It was a mixture of jazz and comedy.
Right. Oh, so you were already doing a show completely on your own?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, you missed that out?
Well, I mean, you just built up a lot of material.
Right.
And I did... I remember I put together... In those days, if you could think of a theme for a show that involves somebody famous, it happens now, you know, like tribute shows, you see the ABBA tribute show or whatever, you know, people go and see that. Well, I had a thing which is called a tribute to Hoagy Carmichael, the songwriter, which is like a 2-hour show. And my first Edinburgh, because we thought in terms of theatre, so we did a split week, thinking this would help, you know, not understanding anything about Edinburgh. I did 10 days at Edinburgh. And I did a show that was far too long in a folk place when what I was doing was essentially comedy and jazz. Everything, plus musical. This wasn't as crucial a mistake as it would be now, because it was a much more relaxed thing, Edinburgh there. Plus the Edinburgh book was in strict alphabetical order, so things weren't segmented off into different genres, which I was right not to have when I was on the committee. But what can I do? I didn't get any of my ideas through what comes to that. So I did this 10 days, and I remember my first 4 days at Edinburgh, I did 9 people, 7, 13 and 11. And I did like a 2-hour show to them. And it was in a place with, you know, a bit of black sugar paper on the windows, got a light out, a little amplifier, 2 microphones and some chairs. That was what we did in those days. There's none of this.
There's still a lot of that around.
Only on the sort of not if you want to get a big audience, it's all marketing.
Slicker, yeah.
And I think the price of the ticket was too quick, you know. It's,
yeah.
And anyway, so I'd done these 4 nights, and then somebody said, why don't you do the Fringe Club? What's the Fringe Club? I said, Fringe Club was a big cast-like structure in TV at Rome. And every night they had a self-booking cabaret, which turned out to be for various reasons. I did the top hall, called the Debating Hall, and I... not to put too fine a point of it, took the roof off. So my first 5 days at Edinburgh went this night,
horribly
7,
wrong.
13, 11, yes. 29.
Yeah.
From then on, zonk. I only did 10 days, but I actually made 40 quid profit.
Yeah.
And now I'd learned something straight away. For the next 17 years, 18 years, I did it every year. Until, it was like that until 1990 and so far. And suddenly the big 3 venues got together, and they bought vintage buses in to take people from one to the other, and all of a sudden it became a 2-level festival, the big 3 and everybody else.
Yeah.
And I kept books of all my ticket sales, and the line went exactly up and down on the same day as the way it had done, but 30% down. And at that point I had to sort of dig deep and think, now what can I do to come? You can't get more people in, so I've got to cut my expenses. So I did 18 years and never lost money at Edinburgh. Although I'm in the Guinness Book of Records for doing more shows than anybody else did, 502 so far, I'm more proud of the fact that I never lost money.
It's harder. Yes. Yeah,
it means
more.
Keep going, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I never lost money. I always made money.
Yeah. And what? How are you building your shows then? The first show you did, as you said, was...
The first show was a tribute to Hoagy Carmichael, sorry.
Yeah.
And it was the wrong show, the wrong thing. And then it was due to my dentist.
What, the comedy dentist?
Yes.
Right.
He had a show with... what's his name now? He's now a comedy producer on the BBC. Clark. And they had a double act, and they did shows at some peculiar place, which was a snooker hall, Marco's Leisure Centre. And I was let down by the one of the big three, the one in George Washington.
Assembly rooms?
Assembly room, yeah. And they messed me about. They told me they wanted me, and then they changed just on when it was almost too late. Oh, sorry, we changed our mind. When they made it virtually sure that yes, they wanted me, and then they let me down. I was really pissed off with them. Now they got somebody obviously that they could make more money with you. So Simon said, "Oh, I love your show. Do you fancy doing it in our venue?" So I went on Midnight. It was called Erlogan's Midnight Follies, and it started difficultly, as it always did. Difficultly, is that a word? Anyway, I then did some of my Fringe Club things, gave out leaflets, so on, filled up towards the end. And in those days, most people went home after the first 2 weeks because they, you know, they'd done the weekend when all the TV were there. That's what they were there for. And then they went home, leaving the last week to the real fringes. And I cleaned up on the last week, so I was getting 100 people, 150.
But still, how did you design your show? When each year, what did you?
Every it was always some old favourites, something new, and something so old that people wouldn't remember it. That's how I kept going. And it was always a mixture of one or two straight songs, and then a lot of various sorts of comedy songs, some with a piano, some with a guitar. The idea being that they would never see two songs in succession that were the same. Because my idea was there's only one person on stage, and they've got to watch me for over an hour, to do an hour and a quarter is my idea. And I don't want them getting bored and looking at their watch. I want the 1 hour and a quarter to seem like 45 minutes. And the way you do that is to break it up to chunks, and the next chunk is nothing like. So if the first one's funny, the second one will be a different sort of funny, or will be at the piano instead of the guitar, and it keeps changing, so I don't know what I'm going to do next. That's the way I would
keep them alert.
Keep them alert, yes.
Yeah.
So that was,
and you never did it with anybody else, you always did it on your own.
All my own.
Right.
I paid for it myself, I hired it for myself, I paid it all out of my own back pocket, I did it alone. And from Simon I learned something very important. He used to have really silly titles. I remember one was Whoops, Vicky, you split the packet. And I don't know what it meant, but it sounded vaguely disgusting. And people came in because of the title. So that's how I thought of my first thing. Earl Oakin does horny things with his mouth. Okay, and it was always puns on that from then on. And the reason I kept doing it is because if people had seen me before, it would remind them who I was. So like, Earl Oakin is horny again, or it's always, you know, always that pun. And if they didn't have seen me before, then it wouldn't matter anyway. So it was still a good title, wasn't it? There were lots of things like still horny after all these years, or old horny mouth is back, or there was always puns on that general idea.
Theme.
Yes. And one of the most successful ones was the one thing I still use, Musical Genius and Sex, and that was great. Right. The big one that didn't work, I was doing out of Edinburgh, I got a lot of work abroad and I became a bit of a name in Germany. And one year I called it Star of German Comedy, which didn't work at all because people thought that Germans don't have comedy.
And they couldn't even see it as an ironic title.
No, they missed the irony, totally. So that didn't work. I mean, I got people in the end just by live shows, but that was a mistake. I went back to the tried and trusted. And then I started doing my main show when they started sectioning off the book, you know, which I didn't like.
Program, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, comedy and drama and all this stuff. So then I thought, okay, I've got to do this completely comedy then, or pretty much. I might do one song that wasn't in the middle of it. I remember one year I did this song called Miss Earth's Regrets by Cole Porter, and I do it in such a way, it's funny if it was written as a comedy song, you know, making fun of these butlers who say, yes, he's being hanged, madam, and, but still keeping his... But you've only got to give it a little tweak, and it becomes a tragedy that the butler's trying to keep it going, and he's actually on the verge of tears. And I can do that, and I can have the room going cold, and people just... You can feel the ice in the room, you know. So I used to do this as a sort of thing, and then bring him around with something funny at the end. And I did it one year. You know, listen, you're going to get bad crits, and people are not going to like you. But when they completely miss the whole point, that's when you get pissed off. And this guy's written... I don't know why he did that song. It wasn't funny at all. And you think, duh. You know, hello, you're a critic, you know. So, you know, that's annoying because they've missed the entire point of it. but if they don't like my voice or they don't find my jokes funny, fair enough. But when somebody's so thick they don't know what you're doing, then it's... Anyhow, I did this various venues, and but my main fun of it was doing things like the Fringe Club. I'll tell you one story. I did two stories about it. There was a place called the Bear Pit, which was one of the places you could perform, and it was very dangerous because you performed in a corner, and there was a balcony behind you. And if they didn't like you, they'd pour beer on you, or anything, or derision, or who knows what they poured on you. And there was a man one year who was doing a very strange show. It was something to do with Zen Buddhism or something. He was a man in his 60s, I think, 50s anyway. Very thin and bony, as we discovered, because he talked about it, stark naked and standing on his head for an hour.
Fantastic. Good Fringe stuff. I'd go and see that.
I'm sure. But he decided to book himself into this late night bear pit. And I saw it, and you just put your own name, you found a little line, and it said 11:15, 11:30, and you put your name down. You booked yourself when it was full. That was the bill for the evening. Nobody asked you, you just turned up. That's what I liked about it, you see. So he turned up, and I thought, maybe I'll just hang around and just do a bit of counselling and bandaging, you know. And it comes the time, and on he goes. And he had a dressing gown on, and suddenly it came off, and there he was, upside down, bony, ribs showing, and everything else. And it was the only time I ever saw the entire bear pit totally silent. People with mouths open, staring. It was just one. I mean, I thought I was going to say he definitely had balls, but I mean, you know, on various levels. Yes.
No, there was one up in this year in Edinburgh. I don't really remember the name of the show, but I saw them doing an equivalent type of show late at night to promote their show, and they had a minute and they came on completely naked, Scandinavian foursome, two couples, and they came on with buckets, completely naked, and for a minute they peed and defecated into the buckets and talked about their show, which nobody listened to, because everybody, the whole place, which had been baying for blood when they came on, they just opened their mouths and just went, "What?"
Yeah.
And that went on for a minute, and then they quietly got up, took their buckets off, and that was the end of their promotional.
Bit of a shitty show though, really.
Bit of a shitty show, exactly. They were taking the piss. And I don't think anybody knew what the show was, because they were just not listening.
Scott was quite serious. That was the thing about it. He was just seriously.
So were these four. Apparently the show was about naturism or something. I don't know.
Oh dear.
But nobody
went to
the
show. I can imagine not.
Still going. No, good Fringe
you
stuff.
You get free gas masks or what? Anyway, the other one was even funnier, was this one. It was to me that I used to prefer the top hall because it was. I ruled. Let me be honest. I did
your
rule.
Kingdom.
It was my kingdom. And every now, I didn't do too many because otherwise people would say, "Why go to the show? I can see him up there." You had to be careful to sort of, you know, every so many days. I've got there early. You've got free buns as well, which is quite good when you're trying to save money. You've got free buns. And I wasn't on the Atkins diet then. So anyway, so I was up there, and there was a great big long room about the size of the room we're in now, which is what? 15 yards by 5 yards?
Yeah.
And it was a sort of green room, if you will, but it was full of things like piles of chairs and tables and odds and sods that just, you know, they shoved in there. But it was our hangout room, changing room, whatever. I got up there early, about 11:30, and I was on... I don't know, whenever I was supposed to be on later. And the first crowd that I remember coming, it was fairly early on, and there was this very modern dance group who apparently had appeared, not quite naked, but just, you know, underwear, and then they had to cover themselves with grey chalk before they could dance. So my guess is that they were statues of some sort. And they went on, and there was this, you know, drunken Scottish audience, but they were not a comedy audience. If you were good at what you did, they would appreciate it. And they would never take any hatred over one act onto the next act. So it wasn't like a comedy club. It was not, had its own special magic. And there was no compere, just somebody off stage with a mic saying, "And now we have so-and-so." That was it. And a wonderful sound guy. Big fat guy. His name I can't remember. Big John. Great sound, great lights. So they went on and they did what they did, and it went down all right. While they're on, the next thing on was a complete youth musical. So while they're on stage, in come 70 dancers and singers, plus a 40-piece orchestra, all in Napoleonic costumes, right? And the room, big as it was now packed, so that it was like rush hour in a tube. That's how closely packed people were. And they're all waiting to go on. I'm sitting on top of one of the parts of the chairs watching all this from the corner. Three dancers now come off and have got to get back to their clothes, and they're pretty naked and covered in chalk dust. Watching them squeeze between this entire cast of this youth opera, chalk dust flying everywhere. They probably had sex with two people inadvertently, because that's how packed it was, trying to get back to their clothes. One of the seminal moments in my life, I think. I'm not quite sure what it did to me, but I was absolutely falling about. I nearly fell off the chair, really, literally. So I can't really do it justice in words. You had to be there, but my God, it was funny.
All the best ones aren't.
The other one I liked about Edinburgh was the spirit of Edinburgh. There was a bunch of students or something that had put on something somewhere, and they wanted to save money on accommodation, so they wanted to sleep in their theatre. And they were told by the council they couldn't do that because they only had license as a theatre, not as a hotel. So they thought about it, and they put on an extra show that year, and it was called 7 Hours of Restful Sleep. And it began at midnight, cost £1. It was very successful. Hundreds of people came in every night.
To sleep as well.
And it cast a lot of supine bodies, and they made a fortune out of it.
That is genius.
That is genius. To me is the spirit of Edinburgh. That is it. If people ask me, what is Edinburgh? That is, for me, that defines it. Yes.
It's fantastic. Yes. Did you, so why did you stop doing Edinburgh?
Right. After the three things came in, it ruined everything because...
You mean when they split the programme into three parts?
No, that was bad enough. That didn't help. The big three venues.
Okay.
Because it then became a two-layer festival. It became the professional. And look, we all want to be discovered. The people from the TV are essentially lazy. They hung out at the George Hotel and would go maybe to across the road to, you know, the nearest
assembly rooms,
which was, that was the original big venue, and then it became later on
Cowgate and the Pleasance.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the third one of the trio, which was Karen's one. And so these people would employ PR agents, and they were in at these. So the TV people would only go there. Plus, Avalon started producing these very immoral, what they would, wouldn't they? Pamphlets which looked like
Avalon Agency,
running their own comedy festival. People thought, oh, that's a comedy festival. There isn't a comedy festival. It's not a comedy festival. It's an arts festival. But it was a copy of the cover of the real catalogue, and, you know, all that sort of stuff started happening. And so I got really annoyed because... And they're also screwing their own acts, as you may know, because they sell out and discover that they're then owed Avalon £5,000, which then had to pay off.
£20,000, yeah.
Yeah, by doing gigs. And then they say, don't worry, you can pay it off. And then, of course, they were charging double what they were paying them. The whole thing was a complete rip-off, as you know. And they said, well, and the people on the fringe committee said, well, that's their lookout, you know. I said, but don't you realise it's also screwing the other artists who aren't with them, because we can't match their PR back pocket, yeah? So it's making a two... They really didn't care about the ethos of the fringe. It took me 3 years to get elected onto the fringe board because they had a, shall we say, dodgy election system. Put it mildly. I won't go into details for the minute. It'd be too long. When I finally did get on it, because I fought fire with fire, I thought, if you can play that game, I'll play it. So I found a way of doing it. And I got on. But they weren't interested. They had Simon, what's his face, as the so-called comedy forgotten his name now. Fanshawe. He was supposed to be the comedy expert. That's funny as a wet Sunday, he was.
He won
Perrier once. God only knows why. And he obviously left the comedy circuit because he discovered he wasn't really funny, and he became an expert on Radio 4. And he was in with them, and it was all a little clique, you know. And nobody wanted to hear the message I was giving them. They lost money on the Fringe Club 1 year, so that went. The only thing that's left of the original Fringe thing is that first Fringe Sunday in the Park.
Which is pretty fringe in the Marquees. I've emceed that, yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of fun, yeah.
It's fantastic to do.
Well, that was much more like the way the Fringe was when I first did it.
But it's still in a tent in the daytime, which makes comedy not harder, but it's benefits some acts that it wouldn't.
Yes, it was fine for me, but yeah. But it's got that real feeling. It's real, you know. It's not hype. It's just real. And Harvey and the Wallbangers were the big flavour 1 year, weren't they? I mean, everybody went to see them.
The Assembly Rooms, we did. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. They were very big for 2 or 3 years.
In 1984. Yeah. Well, we did four years, but the Assembly.
In the 1980s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Assembly Rooms was.
There. I mean, it was one of those must-have tickets for. But that was the only big venue then, really.
Yeah.
Then, in the late 80s, we had the Australians came over, the Australian comedy phenomenon, which was called Osnosh. And I met the three, are still my mates, the Doug Anthony All-Stars, who were the Marx Brothers meet the Sex Pistols, weren't they? And they took the bear pit. Somebody tried pouring beer on them. Don't do that to them. The other two carried on. One of them climbed up and poured a jug of beer over the guy who did. I mean, don't try to heckle them. I took them along to the top hall of the Fringe Club and said, this is how you get, you know, the first year they didn't know anything about it. And the previous act had died a horrible death. I don't know whether this was the time, but it was something like the time when some poor, young, innocent American comedian had gone on stage and his first line was to Scottish grunts at night. Hi, everybody. It's great being here in England. Oh, dear.
Blood on the carpet.
Bottles, beer, glass, the lot. He had no idea why. It was explained to him afterwards. And from that, can you imagine what it was like? It was like World War II. And then they changed things around, and then they said, ladies and gentlemen, Earl Oakin. And between me walking on and getting to the middle of the stage, it's gone as silent as the grave. And I said, hello, children. And I had a great gig. And at the side, watching all this mayhem going on, were the Dugs, and they saw this, but they all went green looking at this. But they, you know, when that audience went, it went, you know. And then, much to their astonishment, there was nice as kittens for
turned
me.
Into happy little
and
bunnies.
I could see them go, oh, I see, you've got to be good. Okay, we could do that. And then it was, you know. So that's what I miss about Edinburgh. That's why I don't do it anymore. I went up there last year for one night for something or other, and 2 years ago, and I did the one night and I had a nice time. And then I, as the evening came to an end, I thought to myself, I'm really pleased I'm not here for 3 weeks. It's very nice for one night visiting, swan about, pretend I'm a celebrity here. Yes, I've done Edinburgh. And then bugger off home again. I've done it. At the end of the day, at some point, fun or not, do it to be discovered. Yeah? And I was never going to be discovered. I got work a lot in Europe out of it because the Germans would say, I see the stand-up, but it's too much below the belt. We not to find this funny. We know we have stuff below the belt, but why talk about it all the time? It's not funny for us. So, but they like what I did because it was more subtle, you see. And they love music. They have a whole genre in Germany called Kleinkunst, which means comedy with music, juggling, whatever. It's like a variety act, but doing a one-man show, Kleinkunst, they call it. It's in Austria, and it's in Switzerland, it's in Italy, and it's in France, they call it Café Théâtre, and it's in Holland and Belgium, everywhere, except England, yeah? So I got a lot of work there, but I was never I did one little two bits of TV in the 80s when I first went up there, and then when I had something really interesting to show them, even my last year, my 500th show, and I told all the team, and they say, oh yeah, we've used you though. I said, that was 17 years ago though. Do you not think I just might have improved or changed? When all they wanted was young, new, or already famous. So the agenda for Edinburgh TV is either be new or within that year be discovered and be a name on TV already, and then we'll use you again. Otherwise, boom, we've used
bonk
you.
Bonk stuff out.
Yeah.
Alright, let's just end on that because we're running in a second. End of part 3.